and leave it to him.
I've been working with a fellow by the name of Lin Kwam for a number of years, and we've been affiliated with SRI International in California. So it's the overview of the talk here. So I'll go over some history of the project. This is really more of a demonstration of a system that is used for image and video processing, and most of it's based in Lisp. And I'll go over some of the fundamentals behind the system, and interleaved with that, I'll do some demonstrations, and then cover some specific applications. Just for the curious, this machine is a MacBook dual core. It's running Franz Allegro, and the compiler we've been using on this machine is GCC. And it's got an ATI Radeon graphics card. We got a chipset. So FreeUS is the most recent in the line of systems developed at the Artificial Intelligence Center at SRI in the perception program. The earliest version of this system, probably the earliest version, was known as ImageCalc, and it was an image processing workbench that was developed for the Symbolics Lisp machine around the mid-80s. That led to a system called TerrainCalc, and here this screenshot here is taken from a TerrainCalc flyover of the Yosemite Valley. It's probably one of the first examples of the sort of thing you'd see on Google Maps these days, or Google Earth, where you're doing fly-throughs over rendered terrain. But this was done around 1984, and it's one of the first, if not the first, known example of that kind of animation. And then that led to a further system called CME, which was used for overlaying geometry on imagery. Most of this is an outgrowth of US government-funded programs in image understanding research. So there's this list is sort of the line of descent of ImageCalc, CME, and FreeUS. The focus, one of the foci in this project was rigorous photogrammetry. So in other words, to overlay geometry on imagery consistently and correctly, you need to get the photogrammetry right before. That involves creating sensor models, detailed, accurate sensor models for the imagery. Another aspect of the systems that we've been developing are their sort of what I might call production level imagery ingest and processing. So they had to be able to handle very large images and products from other places like the USGS or Esri shape files, for example, or descriptions of geometry, geo-referenced. And the geometry represented in FreeUS or CME is usually parametric solids, so we use a few parameters to vary these generic shapes like Quonset huts. Another advantage of using Lisp that has really been true throughout this the evolution of the system is that you can create somewhat arbitrary annotations, so you're not really constrained in what kind of semantic attachment you can place on an object. And that sort of distinguishes our system from some of the main GIS systems. FreeUS is a rewrite of 3DS. So 3DS was developed. the idea being that 3DS ran only on Suns at one point and was encumbered by a lot of licensing issues, and so Lynn and I developed FreeUS as a Mozilla licensed effort. And it's portable. It inherits most of the properties of 3DS, has an eval cache for fast recall of previous computations. As you can understand, if you're doing intense computations on images and they take a while, you don't want to be in a position of having to recompute those every time you need them. So there's a feature we call the eval cache that allows you to cache the computation and recall it. We have representations for various site features. There's a list here. And it supports geospatial queries. Sort of on the more nuts and bolts side, the system requirements, it's portable, it runs under Linux, Windows, macOS, and Solaris. Uses CMU or Allegro Common Lisp. Some core operations are in C and C++. And we're constantly debating with ourselves as to how much of that should be in C. But we do call out to libraries like OpenGL for graphics acceleration, and some third-party libraries for image interchange, like JPEG, TIFF, and TickleTK is used as our sort of core GUI system. There's an example of display. This looks okay, I guess. So the GUI is arranged as a series of panes, one image per pane. The images can have arbitrary viewpoints. They could be orthographic projections, or satellite images, or ground images, and the geometries are overlaid on the imagery. This is just a diagram of the system components. So there's a Lisp core, which is sort of the guts of the system, and that calls out to different other components like the OpenGL, GUI, and any foreign libraries that we may need. We do use a lot of foreign libraries in the course of operations, so things like libgeotiff or libmpeg, libdd, when we need to handle certain other kinds of foreign data types. Images are at the core of Freedius, so there's support for very large images on the order of 100 megapixel, and these are usually essentially paged objects, so we'll use some of the TIFF primitives for doing that. There's also support for a wide variety of pixel types. So we have 8, 16, 32-bit, integer, floating point, color, variety of color image types. And another feature of the system that helps us, especially with things like white V, is the use of map arrays for fast indexing. So if you do an iref of an image, well, iref is sort of the pixel access primitive, counterpart to aref. Really, that gets decomposed into an aref of the image array, where the index is the sum of the two indexes into the two mapping arrays. And that, this is reversed, but the benefit of that is something like YUV411 is an uneven geometry, where you have four times as many Y components as you have human V components. So the mapping arrays allow you to, given a master sort of YUV image like this, you see the YU and V color components are interleaved. The map arrays allow you to extract that and sort of synthesize image planes that look like they have the same geometry, even though some of the indices are replicated. So the U values will be replicated in reality, but to the user, it just looks like three individual components with the same geometry. This is the image class hierarchy. Again, this is all, these are CLOS classes, CLOS classes. We have image at the top. Images can be vector or scalar types. Scalar images can be array images or paged images. So typically an array image is something that would be completely resident in RAM, whereas a paged image is something that would have to live out on the disk somewhere and get paged in tile by tile. And the components of color images, for example, can be either array images or paged images. So there's a sort of a strict tree. But another of the features of interest are these things called lazy images, where pixel evaluation only occurs on reference. So for example, that's used in tiling paging images in. It's only when, obviously only when the pixel is evaluated do you construct that you sort of fill in that portion of the image. Another very important feature of this system is the transformation hierarchy. Just want to check, make sure I'm not. I don't want to spend too much time on this and get to the demonstrations. But in order to overlay geometry on the images, you need to have a chain of transformations that describes where everything is in the world. So this diagram on the upper right kind of shows you a chain of transformations that goes through that blue blue thing is supposed to be the Earth, and there's a chain of transformations that takes you from some geocentric coordinate system to some point on the surface, let's say, which is really a Cartesian coordinate frame that's locally, you know, that's a local coordinate frame for geometry. In turn, there's a way of relating that to any given imaging event, which would produce an image. So that's called a 2D world. And the image is related to the 2D world in part because a given image might be part of a pyramid. So the 2D world would represent the base of the pyramid, and any given image would be a power of 2 reduction of that resolution. So there's a transformation. Each one of these things is a coordinate system object, and pairs of coordinate system objects are related by transformations that take you from one coordinate system to the other. So anytime you see a display like this where there's geometry overlaid on the image, really what it's doing is working through the transformations that take, let's say, a point in an object coordinate system, brings that into this local Cartesian coordinate system, and then projects that into one of the images. So that's what's outlined here. You have a step that takes you from some geocentric or lat-long coordinate system onto an image, onto the local Cartesian coordinate system. In this case, we're using this group of features in yellow here. That's actually part of an indoor environment we use for tracking, and I'll show you some of that later. But that has its own local coordinate system, so that's another level of transformation that you go through before you actually can overlay local site geometry onto images. Just a few words about the GUI. We are looking into things like LTK, but right now we have sort of a homebrew TickleTK GUI sort of framework. All TickleTK callouts have Lisp bindings, and all of the callbacks are to Lisp. So there's a central Lisp callback mechanism that allows you to decide whether you're doing things like mouse clicks, button presses, and the like. And it's we chose TickleTK primarily because it's portable. There's a fairly uniform appearance across most of the operating systems, and it's pretty easy to customize. We actually have a little bit of TickleTK code embedded in the system. One of the big, or I should say nicest things about doing this in Lisp is that what we found is that GUI interaction is often context dependent. So every one of those panes in FreeDSY has what we call a view, which is sort of a way of rendering the objects onto the screen. And in our case, we have objects that are both spatial and temporal in nature, and we have views that are also spatial and temporal. So, for example, a basic view is neutral, but the view object, the original view object in FreeDSY, is a spatial rendering of information. So it'll show you the image, it knows how to render the image and geometry on the screen. But there are timeline views which are purely temporal. And you want to be able to render the right object in the right way on the screen. So the way this is done is through a display object method that's actually conditionalized on the view and the object, so that temporal objects have you define the method depending on what kind of view you're using. So for example, the trajectory class looks like a curve in a spatial view, but it looks like a bar in a timeline view. In each case, you have vertices, or what I would call observations in time, that are selectable with the mouse. It's just that in a spatial view, they show up as points, and in a timeline view, they'll show up as segments on the timeline. And in a temporal view is a special kind of spatial view that shows progression in time. So it's a way of displaying video, for example. Let's see. OpenGL, just a few words about it. It's a way of doing fast rendering. We had originally done display lists on our own in X-Windows, and that was a lot of machinery. Now that OpenGL is pretty standardly available. That makes life a lot easier and a lot faster. So let's see. I don't get too far into this. There's a lot of machinery in there as well for doing extraction of features from imagery, so creation of object models from imagery. We've done some research on model-based optimization techniques that sort of use the image intensity to refine the shape of an object. Okay, so why don't I just shift over and show you some aspects of the system. This is the top-level menu GUI. This is, again, TickleTK. Oddly enough, Mac OS X is the one system where things look a little different. I'm using the Aqua version of it. But so it's a basic pull-down menu to allow you to select from sites, for example. This is a list of the sites that happen to be on this machine. Load images. This feature set object is a collection of objects, basically a collection of geometry. There are ways of creating objects. This is a pull-down menu that allows you to place objects on an image. The only thing under views right now is this adjustable copy. So one thing you can do is take a view like this. Strange glitch there. And kind of clone that view and turn it into a synthetic view, but I'll show you some of that in a bit. I guess the action crazy. So one of the things I can do is use the mouse to manipulate the view. I can zoom in here. I apologize if this seems a little goofy. I'm used to using a three-button mouse, and I'm on a Mac, so that's there are a few glitches we have to live through to get that to work. But anyway, the point is that this is a fairly large image. I think it's a few thousand by pixels on a side. And as I zoom in and out, it's actually going in and out of the pyramid. And then when necessary, it's paging out to disk to get the pixels in. But I can drag through with the mouse and inspect the scenery here. That's a road right there. And most of the, really virtually all of these geometric objects are mouse sensitive. They're mouse sensitive when I make them mouse sensitive. So this is a feature set panel that allows me to tell the system what to do with certain features. Right now, that isn't sensitive, so I'll turn it on and make it sensitive. And once I do that, we've got faces are highlighted. There is a mode where I can select vertices as well. So right now, it's just faces. But the point is that the features of the object can be selected, objects can be selected, and we can use that context to determine what the pop-up menu should look like. So for example, in this case, the pop-up menu is image-based. So this tells me the things I can do with sort of at the image level. Whereas if I select here, a pop-up menu that's object-based, so I can drop the object to the terrain, I can move it in X and Y, I can move it in along the line of sight of the camera, I can scale it, I can rotate it. So those are the sorts of things that we're allowed to do with objects. If I try to move X, Y, this just places it on the terrain, for example. Move the object around. So that, I think, gives you a basic idea of what the system looks like at a sort of GUI level. There are a number of keyboard shortcuts as well. Right now I'm using the arrow keys to so this just gives you an environment in which you can play with the image, you can play with the objects. If I click with the mouse on this image, what we should see, if I can bring up the see, what we would see if I could go down here far enough, is that the object that I'm selecting ends up in the list listener and is bound to star, so that the listener is tightly coupled with this GUI here. Likewise, each one of these panes, these windows, is a stack of views, so I can push views onto the stack or cycle them around depending on what I want to look at a given time. Let's see. A bit here. Another application is the use of what we call a camera bag for refining or providing seed values for a projection. So in this particular site that you see here, we had to place ground cameras and model them. So an easy way of doing that is if you could, you know, have the camera object sort of situated in the site, you can move it around and manipulate it to get a good seed for the view. And this is really just an extension of the projection class. So one of the transformations that's in the transformation chain is the projection that brings the objects into the camera imaging plane. And that extension, love this. All right, just refresh here. We call it a camera bag, but it's an extension of a frame camera object. And we can, for example, roll that camera, and you'll see, so the green triangle on the right is the camera frustum, and the left-hand pane, you'll notice, is changing in response to my mouse movement. So the idea there is that taking a static camera and building on it, we can sort of attach it to the GUI and allow the user to manipulate the camera to get a better fit of the object features to the projection. And really, the alternative to doing this is what's called resection, where you're doing an optimization of the projection. But that doesn't always work, especially if you have a lot of degeneracies in the data. So we develop this as sort of a fallback. Likewise, you can change the position. Move this in X and Y. So you see the camera moving around on the right-hand side and the features moving around on the left. The next thing I want to talk about is indoor tracking. So at SRI, we have a sensor system that's got six stereo sensors arranged in the hallway in the offices. And this gives you an overview of that system. But these are Fredius views. And the sensors track movers in the field of view, and they store image sample information and XYZ location relative to the sensor, as well as some stereo information. There's some depth information stored as well. And those are saved by each tracker into a common repository of binary files that have one observation per packet. It's really a simple. And we process those to allow you to visualize. So here we have this just reaches into that data set and displays the tracks that are available. All the tracks are time-stamped in a common time base, and they're each sensor is registered to the to our SRI site model. And so the way the GUI is laid out is that you have the four of the six sensor views here, and you have a timeline view here that allows you to look at the tracks as small green bars. These are events that are detected. I'll get into that later. And you can either scroll the timeline or look at the spatial views to get an idea of what's going on, what's in the data, what events are occurring. I think the next thing. Yeah, that's really all right. So if we go here, this is a little crammed, but it's basically the same kind of display. This is the timeline view, and each one of these is a mouse-sensitive track. Right, well, that's the idea, right? So since we have just an image chip, we typically take a periodic background frame and then reconstitute the video by just overlaying the image chip on the projection. And since all of the coordinate transformations are taken care of, they're represented fairly rigorously, these sensors are calibrated, we can always do that. We can always reconstitute and project into the appropriate field of view. So if I were to, let's see, this should be mouse moving, it's not. I apologize, Josh, some of this wasn't, I had to reboot my machine probably about 20 minutes before I got talking, so all of this is a, there we go. So again, I just made that feature set sensitive, that's the track feature set, so now I can select the mouse, and you'll notice that at each point, here's an example where the sort of conditional rendering is happening on each view. I have a spatial view here that I'm doing the selection in terms of a spatial point, but it's highlighting the temporal point here that corresponds to that same spatial point. And then at the same time, overlaying the image chip in the appropriate view. So this is a sensor in which that point, from which that point was sampled. And if I use minus on this pane, I can zoom out in time. That allows me to see more and more of the tracks that. Now I've done it. A little too ambitious there. There we go. A lot of tracks. Part of the problem is, well, that's just. So you see all the tracks that were assembled in that time interval for some reason. Don't worry about that. So let me zoom back in a little.
See, is this?
Yeah, you can see that. So if I use the mouse button, play backward and forward, or I can use play here to sort of reconstitute the. The point is that I can do direct access of the tracks, do searches on the tracks, look at the tracks in either space or time to get a better understanding of what's going on. And this gets more important if we talk about activity recognition. So we want to be able to go back and verify not only who was involved in the event, but what kind of event it really was. Let's see. This is a byproduct of OpenGL, is that you get fast rendering. And this is a rendered view of the site with the we go back to this view, the yellow indicates geometric features that were put in the site, but there are also features that aren't obvious in that view that are shown here. These are zones of interest that we use for defining certain kinds of events. So we do automatic event detection based on the track activity. And I think I'll, how much time do I have? 5 minutes, okay. So I'll skip this. I've already mentioned this, but the ground-based tracking, another aspect of our research is airborne tracking. So we'll take sequences from airborne video and try and track objects on the ground. And there the challenge is stabilizing the video. So we have another tool that's sort of similar to the one you just saw called the Video Light Table. It's a similar idea. In other words, you've got tracks that are registered in space and time, and you've got video accompanying those tracks, and pre-registered ground information like a USGS ortho image or site geometry that you've already acquired from some other source. And the idea there is that you can overlay, and you'll only see part of this display, but we'll just wing it. So I just started the video playing there, and this machine doesn't have quite enough power to do this the way I'd like to do it. But what you're seeing here are tracks overlaid on the video. So the video we bundle adjusted, and that's a process whereby we can create more or less accurate camera models for each frame of the video sequence. So that way we have a full transformation chain, and we can project all of the ground geometry, including the tracks that we detected, into a given video view or into a geospatial view like this one. This is a much older image. This was taken about 10 years ago, so you don't see a lot of the buildings and things here in this image. But the point is that, again, you've got this rigorous transformation hierarchy that you can use to make sure that all this information gets registered into a common framework in any direction. So, briefly, so all of this is building up to event recognition. That's one of our major research thrusts now. There the idea is that we use tracks to detect low-level events and then use this first-order logic description to infer high-level events from that low-level event stream. We're using a few tools to do that work now. Some of them are Lisp-based, in which case it's really easy for us to interface with them. Let's see if I can... I'm going to zoom ahead here. So this is just some of the stuff we've been doing in terms of defining templates for higher level patterns. Convoy is one of the examples that we've been using recently. I just wanted to get to this because I think, Lisp has been really a convenient language for doing this in, and the Lisp macro facility is just compared to C, which is the other language that we typically use, it's just phenomenally more powerful. We make a lot of use of multi-methods, especially for GUI operations, as I mentioned before. We've got a mix of temporal and spatial renderings with temporal and spatial object types. Makes it a lot easier to deal with. True multiple inheritance is also really valuable. For example, when we want to mix time into existing inherently spatial object classes, it makes it very easy to do. And condition handling is very useful for wrapping up demonstrations and allowing the system to behave robustly when we have to deploy it. That's just a little list of some ongoing research that we're doing. I think I already mentioned at this point. So I think that's it. We are looking at using GPUs, though. So one of the things I'd like to try to do is put maybe some MMX code into Prettius, hard hand code. And then another effort that we have is looking at the newer GPUs to see if we can do some sort of stream computation, feed some of our computations into that.
How many of the low-level fixed algorithms do you have in C, and how much of that is in Lisp?
I'd say most of the C is in support of things like I/O, and interface to foreign functions. We make a lot of use of TIFF and JPEG and TickleTK. There is some C code for marshaling raster and column extraction, and there is a Gaussian smoother that's currently in C, along. It's not clear that that actually needs to be. We have a Lisp and a C version, and it's not clear that the C version is that much of improvement.
Chris?
Almost stuff like edge detection, that's all in Lisp.
Yeah, we usually code it up in Lisp, yeah.
You mentioned about Lisp's paper 2 years ago, so most of these people...
Yeah, so that was fast slot access, right? Was that the...
yeah, several things.
He was last year.
A year and a half ago with Stanford.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I guess that was... The thing I remember about that was the fast slot access referring to, do you think there's something in particular?
No, well, that whole effort of the merits of Lisp, but he's been a four.
Well, he's done a lot of work in that area, and he's done a lot of benchmarks too that suggest that it's really it's more a matter of how you code in Lisp than the fact that you're using Lisp or C versus C.
Absolutely.
There are a few benchmarks he did it a number of years ago, I think, that where he was able to get much better performance out of Lisp, actually, and doing some of that low-level image processing. And I found that, you know, if you declare it, your variables properly in Lisp, that counts for a lot, putting the right declarations in.
You said it's over 20 years that you've been, your group has been working on this. Can you give an estimate of how many person years have gone into...
All told.
Yeah, add it up.
I don't know. Lynn's been there since the beginning. The problem is that the people have come and gone, too, and I think, you know, there's at least...
How big's the group at the moment?
At the moment, three people maybe who were involved in this particular effort. So if you figure three people over the course of 20 years, Lynn being worth two of them.
Right.
that's probably maybe a little more like 50, 60 million or whatever.
The amazing thing is that you've got a project for which the government has been funding it for 20 years and hasn't changed its mind.
More or less, sort of. Lately it's been, this is, well, as I said, the Freedius itself is SRI funded.
Oh.
So, but I use it in all of my projects. So it's not that they're funding Freedius, but they're funding the work that we're doing with. That's a win, I suppose.
All right, well, I suggest that we break for lunch. We restart at 22, and could we just thank Chris once